Support for Sound Effect on KNKX comes from WSECU, who feels that during this unprecedented time, thanks is not a big enough word for what you're doing and what you're giving up. WSECU is in awe and is grateful. WSECU is a credit union that's served Washington since 1957. WSECU is with you all the way.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and today we're featuring more stories from our podcast Transmission, which has been covering the coronavirus pandemic in the Northwest. As the weeks have ticked by, some clear patterns have emerged. One is that people of color are being affected by this virus at higher rates than white people. In Washington state, the disparities are especially stark among the Latino population. More than a third of the state's COVID-19 patients have been Latino, which is way out of proportion to their share of the general population, just 13%. Yakima County, where the population is more than half Latino, has the highest rate of COVID-19 infections in the state. This is what Dr. Julian Perez sees playing out at CIMAR Community Health. It's a network of clinics originally founded to care for immigrant farm workers. Dr. Perez works out of White Center, just south of Seattle. About 40% of his patients are Latino, yet he says they make up more than 80% of the positive COVID tests at his clinic. Dr. Perez recalls one patient who tested positive.
At the time, I said, "So what's going on in your work?" And she said, "Well, I work at a restaurant in the area, and everybody there is sick. Everybody's coughing. We've reported it to the boss. The boss is on vacation and tells us we have to stay there and keep working or else we'll be fired." I said, "Really?" And she said, "Yeah, please don't tell anybody. I'll be fired." So, of course, what did I do? I went to public health and I told them. And they are investigating that business. And she told me that they're not the only one. She has lots of friends who are working in restaurants and they're under the same types of conditions. And of course, if they're sick, they'll send them home, but they don't send them home very long. They usually call them up 2 or 3 days later and say, "Are you in the hospital?" "No." "Can you come back to work?" "Yes." "Okay, get back to work." So I think there's several things going on out there. We have a large community of people from Latin America who are undocumented and they really want to stay under the radar. They don't like to rock the boat. And they need money to pay rent. And I think that's not a secret. Everybody knows this. And then they come home and they're sick and they spread it to their family.
Why is this population so vulnerable? And what's being done to prevent things from getting worse? Dr. Perez suspects the reason most people in his clinic who test positive are Latino is in large part because they work in the service industry and have kept going to work during the pandemic. But Dr. Perez thinks there's something else at play, too. KNKX's Will James picks it up from here.
Since March, public health officials have been driving home the same messages. COVID-19 is dangerous, and the best way to prevent it is to stay away from other people. But Dr. Perez says there was a moment when he suspected that message wasn't reaching some of his Spanish-speaking patients. It was after Easter.
Most of our patients are Catholic. And the sun was out. It was quite beautiful. And I'm quite sure that some of our patients were gathering with family or friends or having barbecues, knowing that they were not supposed to do that, but they felt, well, we'll just get away with it, you know, this one time. And so we saw a bump. So there's a little bit of a lag in the disease because it takes maybe 3 days to set in. It takes about 7 days to become severe. So it was about 7 days after Holy Week and Easter, we saw a bump.
Dr. Perez saw a chance to help his patients before they ever got to his office. It meant stepping out of the clinic and into a role as messenger.
This is KKMO Tacoma, Seattle.
We own and operate two radio stations, so we're able to do our own programming. And I speak every day around noon, and I do an hour from 11 to 12 every Wednesday.
La pandemia del COVID-19. ¿Cómo te va? ¿Cómo estás hoy, Julián?
Bien, saludable, la familia.
I'm not seeing our Spanish-speaking patients wearing masks. I constantly go in the room and they're not wearing something. I say, "Can you please cover your mouth and nose?" And so there is some kind of a public health messaging in that standpoint that's not getting through. "Oh, but I don't have a mask." I said, "Well, do you have a t-shirt? Do you have a bandana? Sock?" I'm like, "Anything. It doesn't matter. You know, just let's cover up." Because entre todos venceremos, right? The message is if we all do it, it will work. But if we don't, it won't.
Even with this high rate of infection in Washington's Latino population, there's a weird bright spot. That high rate of infection is not translating to an equally high rate of death from COVID-19. In fact, Latinos are underrepresented in the death count. There's been no scientific study why. And of course, as we get more accurate data, those numbers might change. But if Latino residents really are dying at lower rates, Dr. Perez has an idea why.
Most of our patients that are here are young. Our patients tend to be living in dense situations. A two-bedroom apartment may have two families in it, but they're younger. And so while they're going to get sick more often, they're going to die less.
He has another theory too. Many of the deadliest outbreaks have been in nursing homes. And he says Latinos, for cultural and economic reasons, are more likely to care for an older relative at home instead of in a facility. But Dr. Perez says the death count doesn't capture the pandemic's full toll. There's a message he's trying to get out to younger Spanish-speaking residents. Even if they survive a critical case of COVID-19, the effects could stay with some of them for life.
What I want young people to know is that with the numbers, like you're saying, to report on numbers, you can say, oh, this percentage of people got sick and this percentage of people died. You know what? We're seeing blood clots in young people. We're seeing strokes. The incredible inflammation that this disease causes is unlike anything I've ever seen. It's ruining the body. It's shutting down kidneys. It's shutting down the lungs. It's causing heart attacks. It's stroking them out. It's clotting their blood. If these people live through this disease, they're going to be disabled for the rest of their lives. I mean, the numbers we see now is just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to have a generation of people that are disabled.
Yeah, he's trying to scare people. It's what doctors do sometimes to get their patients to take their health seriously. But fear only gets you so far. Dr. Perez tries to mix that dire news with some hope.
You know, at the end of the talks, I say, venceremos. Like, we will win. We will beat this thing. It's about hand washing. It's about social distancing. It's about making sure you speak up and at work and make sure that you tell them that you need protections. You need masks. You need gloves. You need, you know, plexiglass screens between you and your friends. And if that can't happen, there's a need for organizing. There's a need for reporting to public health. There's a need to use the voice that you have. Not all of our patients feel like they have a voice. If they're undocumented and they know they can be fired at best case scenario, or that their boss can call immigration and have them arrested and put in detention in Tacoma, I mean, those are pretty severe consequences for trying to use your voice.
If people don't feel safe speaking up, Dr. Perez says there are confidential phone lines they can call and report violations of public health. Throughout the pandemic, there's this thing public health officials have been saying over and over. Even when you feel powerless against this disease, there are things you can do to protect yourself. Dr. Perez is tailoring that message to a specific audience, his patients. For them, in some cases, protecting themselves is literally about power.
Escucharnos en pláticas saludables. Gracias, Julia.
Así, así, Jorge. Muchas gracias y venceremos.
That story from KNKX's Will James. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're sharing more stories from our podcast Transmission, covering life in the Northwest during the COVID-19 pandemic. We've been pretty lucky in this country. We haven't had a pandemic like this in, well, 100 years. But the scourge of influenza back in 1918 is not so remote as you might think. Marianne Moorman is a storyteller, diversity educator, and a longtime civil rights activist. She was not around for the 1918 flu, but she was raised in its aftermath, as well as the aftermath of America's history of racial violence and division. Here's her story.
This is a story about three women. My grandmother Maud, her friend Lulie, and my mother. And they all were the best cooks, and they cooked greens. My mother taught me how to cook them. You roll them up like a dollar bill, and you slice them on the horizontal to get these small little circles. Now, these three women guide my hands when I'm in the kitchen. I can feel them every time I'm on the cutting board. I feel their love and taste their trauma. Lulie and Maud were dead and gone before I was born, but, oh, my mother carried them in their heart. They acted like they were on the sofa. She talked to them so much. Oh, Mama said, oh, how I miss my mother. And Luli, Luli was my salvation. This was confusing to me because Luli was black. She was the daughter of a slave. And my mother thought black people had a place and that they should stay in it. But it sounded like Luli's place was right next to my grandmother Maud. Those two women were born a week apart, and they were raised in the same kitchen where Luli's mother nursed both of them. Fed my mother, taught her to walk, taught her how to shell a pecan, taught her how to sing Amazing Grace. A mixed-race friendship in the early 1900s in Eatonton, Georgia, was unthinkable. I don't think it was allowed. But I figured my grandparents were, well, they were frayed gentry. They never recovered from the war or the fall of cotton in the South. And so they were so concerned with themselves, they didn't notice that their daughter was out under a oak tree with the daughter of the cook. Mama said they used to stay there and tell each other their dreams, tell their stories, and share a little sweet nectar of honeysuckle. Drop it right on the tongue. Luli's dream was to be a nurse. When she learned that Luli didn't get to go to school very often, Luli had to be in the kitchen. She had to work on the sharecropper farm. Well, it just made grandmother mad. So she would come on home from school with her little McDuffie's reader. As soon as nobody was looking, she'd shoo Luli out the back door and they'd run behind the vines on the live oak tree. And Grandmother Maud taught her her letters, taught her how to read, taught her how to do sums. They were good friends. Last March 2020, I'm standing at the stove stirring up all these memories, and I do not know how my diminutive, dignified grandmother became so defiant. And she was defiant, at least in two of the stories my mother told. Now, the first one was when the Jewish people in Georgia, in Eatonton, didn't have enough Jews to be in the choir. So they asked my grandmother, who had a beautiful voice and was going to sing. Well, my grandfather didn't want her to. No, you can't go down with the Jewish people and sing. Well, my grandfather didn't know that the Lord wanted my grandmother to do this, and she took Luli and off they went, walked onto the synagogue outside of town, and she sang. The second time was after World War I, and the soldiers were coming home, and a lot of them were sick with the Spanish flu, and my grandmother didn't like that they were left on the streets and not being taken care of. So she asked Luli to go with her to the makeshift hospital in the church basement. Well, the Red Cross had run out of white nurses, and so they were allowing black women to come in and do some nursing duty. Everything was limited. Grave diggers were in short supply, so were doctors. My grandfather didn't want her to go at all. Thought it was dangerous. He'd drink bourbon on the porch. My mother would sit on the stairs and wait. And Luli and Grandmother Maud would come up the hill at night after they'd worked in the basement. Mama said that once Luli was helping one of the fevered, coughing soldiers, blood running out of his nose, and he rose up in a fevered state and tossed her, just hit her, said, "I don't want any colored person touching me." Well, the man was practically delirious. He didn't know it was Luli who was holding his hand, my grandmother giving him his last sip of water as he slipped away. Turned October, chilly in Georgia that year, 1919. Luli had to help grandmother home, helped her up the stairs. She got into bed. Luli helped her, took care of her, and the cough rose like flames in a fire igniting and got worse. My mother stood in the doorway as Luli held her hand and mother waved goodbye. They had to wait for the gravedigger. Mama didn't get to go to the funeral. They thought it was dangerous, and funerals were only 15 minutes long at that time. They didn't have time. My grandfather really started drinking after that, although my mother never, ever would call him an alcoholic or drunk, but she also never would let us have liquor in the house. He fired Lou Lee, said he didn't have any money. Right after that, he flipped over a car, Model T Ford, rolled it right over with my mother in it. She didn't learn to drive until I did. But she cried. She cried the first 13 years of my life and told me how Lou Lee came back to take care of her. Lou Lee had to work during the day, but at night she'd cook for my mother. She'd sew her clothes and cut her hair. And when Mama graduated from high school, it was Lou Lee standing in the schoolyard to congratulate her. Mama was valedictorian of her class, but she didn't get to go to college. She had to go to work, take care of her father. But Lou Lee got to be a nurse. She went to the Negro College. My mother got the vapors. I think that was the term at the time for depression or PTSD. They didn't have those words. She laid on the sofa. She cried. She talked about Lou Lee. She talked about her mother. And she talked so much about it, I almost drowned in her memories. I was a kid. I couldn't make Mama happy. But I carried her grief until it became my own. Standing at the stove after Seattle went into shelter because of the COVID, I was stirring memories in boiling water and realized I was shaped by a pandemic. I began my life in a pandemic. I never escaped a pandemic and have lived to live through one myself. I have these photographs on my dresser. My grandmother, and she's got her delicate chin resting on her gloved hand. And next to her is my 10-year-old mother. And you can see those sad eyes. You can see that look in her face. I have no photo of Lou Lee. I don't know her last name or where she's buried. But I found a cookbook of my mother's, and I took out the most beautiful bouquet of collards, and I framed it. I put Lou Lee's collards right in the middle of this trinity of women who taught me how to cook, though sometimes I salt my collards with tears.
So, could you just tell me a little bit about what it feels like to tell that story in this time and place where we're confronting another pandemic and we're in this new paroxysm of anguish over racism?
I started thinking about the story in February 2020. It's Black History Month. It's always Black History Month in February. And I was thinking about this unusual friendship that I never quite understood how it happened. And then all of a sudden, a few weeks later, it wasn't the friendship so much I was thinking about. It was a friendship in a pandemic. And I'm standing at the stove, and I realize how much they are part of my life and how I was really shaped by a pandemic that happened at the turn of another century in 1918. And I started thinking, what are kids going to think today? If I was so touched by the memory told to me by another person, what in the world are these children going to think who are experiencing it? Because that's what my mother was 10 years old when this happened, and she never recovered, never recovered.
Could you tell me a little bit about your own history with civil rights?
I grew up in Virginia from a small town, Windy Gap Mountain. My mother wanted to upscale us, so she moved us into the city of Roanoke. And she got us in a private school at a time where the way Virginia was going to fight integration was to take public dollars and give it to children to go to private schools if they were going to have to go to school with a person who was black. I didn't understand why my father thought this was so wrong, but slowly began to understand it so that by the time I was in school, where we genuflected at the bronze statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, Jeb Stuart, and the Klan was marching and making these horrible sounds, beating on garbage cans. I went to Washington, D.C. I watched the crosses that were burning in Richmond, and I began doing voter registration. And when I was doing voter registration, of course I was working with people who were black, and I came back to our little location in the Episcopal Church there, and there was smoke, and there was fire, and fire trucks. And the man I had been doing voter registration with died. The building was set on fire. And I began to work with civil rights. Much later in Seattle, I was a consultant in cultural diversity and worked with City of Seattle. And it's really understandable why people who are black do not want to educate us anymore. They're exhausted. And during the civil rights movement, they did do a lot of teaching. I remember sitting in a church. They would teach us about what it meant to be a peaceful protest, what it meant to not fight back, and what that was going to be. But we did role plays where actually they did cover us in ketchup, and I had to do a whole lot of educating. And then we marched and we demonstrated. And you think that's going to be over. You know, that was one of the problems with those of us who were raised in the 60s. We checked things off. We got affirmative action in. Okay, civil rights is on the way. Brown versus the Board of Education, got that passed. Okay, that's happening. Moving on. What we didn't know was how quickly all of those things could change. When those people who did not want those changes came back to power. And it also is important for this generation, for the next generation, to realize this is your march. And you may be doing it digitally. You may be doing it on the streets. But if you don't do it with love in your heart, you won't be heard.
Yeah. I wonder if anti-racism feels different now, where there are fewer overt signs of the KKK-style cross-burning, and we're really starting to understand more about how racism is institutionalized, how it's systemic, how it's systems of power, and not only individuals who have bad beliefs.
Yeah, in the South in the 60s, we didn't exactly understand racism until the Civil Rights Movement, and then it was you were marching or you were not marching. And then I come to Seattle, and we're polite. We're politely racist. But there's still, if you see two black people in the hallway, if you're white, you got nervous. And now, I don't think moderate white liberals can have this fence post where we stand balancing, well, we'd like people to be nice. There's a correct way to protest. When the very essence and meaning of protest, there's not a right way to do it. The other thing that I think we are learning from the burning of America, and again, you know, there's an African proverb, if the village doesn't take care of the children will burn the village to feel its warmth. Well, it's understandable, but we can't burn our own house. If we use what we have of democracy to take our bully vote, it could help us be a little closer to each other. And I hope that happens. I hope.
That was storyteller and advocate Marianne Moorman. She lives in Kingston, Washington. She first told the tale at the Seattle storytelling series Fresh Ground Stories at a virtual event in May. It's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're bringing you another batch of stories from our podcast, Transmission. The past few months have been hard, really hard. Dr. Michael Caine knows that very well. 5 days a week, 10 hours a day, he's on video calls talking to people about what they're going through. He's a clinical traumatologist, though he's been called a few other names.
The Grief Man. I listen to a lot of grief. Prince of Darkness. And that one, I don't get the Prince of Darkness pit.
Caine likes to phrase it a little differently.
I walk with the wounded.
Most of Caine's patients have experienced trauma, and many of them are African American. The two are deeply linked. In a racist society, African Americans shoulder stress just moving through life. And Kane says there are many different types of trauma that affect his clients. All these traumas have names, 14 of them, but Kane highlighted only one called just world trauma.
Just world trauma asserts that people have a need to believe in a just world, one in which they get what they deserve and deserve what they get. The just world theory corresponds to the principle of goodness, and that the goodness of an individual is a primary factor determining his or her lot in life.
All this forms the backdrop for Michael Caine's daily conversations with patients. At this very fraught moment in America, we checked in with him to hear how he's supporting his clients in their mental health and how he's holding up himself.
We are not in this together. That's the message that I'm receiving from Black America. No, we are not in this together. White America has been practicing distancing from African Americans for 400 years. For 400 years, we have been oppressed. For 400 years, we have been targeted one way or another. We've been held down by Black codes, segregation laws, and we are entitled to be angry. But then again, we're told that if you're angry, oh, that's an angry Black man. You know, oh, we gotta stay away from that guy. You know, and so we seek to minimize our anger. And it's like instead of having a explosion per se to protect the white person from that anger, we have an implosion. The implosion that leads to strokes, heart attacks, high blood pressure, high rate of alcoholism, drug abuse, domestic violence, all these other things that happen because I stuff it in. And so what I'm looking at is for people to understand that we have a right to that anger. Okay. So what I want to do in working with my patients is to let them know that, and this is what I want white America to understand, that anger is nothing more than an emotion. We don't want to push it away. We don't want to hold on to it. We want to express it appropriately. We want to embrace our anger. And then as we embrace it, we want to be able to let it go. I've had patients say to me, you don't know what I've gone through. You're a doctor. And I'm saying to myself, no, you don't know what I've gone through. And I am a doctor. You know, I'm a child of segregation. I went to all-colored school, not an all-Black school, an all-colored school in Virginia, okay? I integrated, forced integration of a white school system where no one spoke to me for 2 years. I know the pain. But of course, I'm not going to sit there and shout all that out to my patient, you know? I am going to hold my stuff and to listen, not just hear, but to listen to this pain. And as I'm listening, the patient gets the understanding, this guy does get me. He does understand me. But no, I've been listening to a lot of pain and suffering over the last 3 months. You know, it's been horrific for me, horrific. And I want to thank my patients as I've been working through video taping or video chatting. I've had patients say to me, Dr. Kane, you don't look good. Are you okay? You know, you don't sound good. You don't look good. And I'm just saying, yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm okay. He said, no, you don't look good. You know, and so I saw what I was doing. I saw that I was putting on a front to protect them, that I wasn't taking care of the self. As a self-psychologist, I felt like a hypocrite because the whole thing is about taking care of the self, and I was not demonstrating that behavior. And so I immediately took 5 days off. My hope would be that my colleagues would make themselves available to listen to the anguish and listen to the pain and simply just hold space. If you can do no more than just hold space for that 45 to 50 minutes. allow the person to know that they're being validated, that they are valued. We understand that a person who is a white clinician may not have the same experiences and awareness as an African American or another person of color. Don't just transfer the case, have the willingness to stay with it and seek consultation as you continue to work with that person. When you transfer the case, you may be overloading the limited resource that we have already. Seek consultation so that we can assist you in getting the wants and the needs of the population and yourself met. The question I get, Dr. King, when will this be over? When will they accept us? When will they stop hunting us? When will they start being a target? I'm listening to the anguish, you know, and I'm not able to give them that answer they're looking for. So what I give them the answer is vigilance, safety, comfort. That's all I can do. We know how to survive. We survive quite well. That's part of the problem, surviving. There are the five levels: existing, surviving, driving. What we want is to be able to drive, to be empowered. We want to be able to strive, to set the pace, to live the lives we want to live. And then finally, we want to be able to thrive, What we want is transformation. Change takes us, we have changed. Oh yeah, we changed, all right. Okay, but we have not transformed. Change takes us forward and takes us back. Here we go, back and forth with change. Transformation, there's no going back. We're going forward.
KNKX's Posey Gruner produced that story. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today, more from our podcast, Transmission, stories from life in the Northwest during the coronavirus pandemic. KNKX's Kari Ploeg has been on a roller coaster ride this year. She shares this story on the limits on our ability to control the forces that are shaping our lives.
Even before this pandemic started, a lot happened this year for me and my husband, Christian. We recently locked ourselves upstairs, away from our pets, to reflect on exactly how crazy life has been since January 2020.
So, my favorite thing about when we found out we were having a baby was that we genuinely didn't know we were pregnant. Remember, I took a pregnancy test because I thought I might be, and I threw it away?
Well, I remember you took it, and we were going somewhere, and I glanced at it on the counter. And I thought, I think that's like a really faint second line. Huh, like that looks like it's positive. And just then you said, yeah, it's negative. It's a negative test. And you said it with such certainty that I thought, oh, well, you know, why would I know?
A few days later, the doctor cleared up any confusion. The nurse just came in and said that we had a positive.
And then you came home and gave me a slice of cake that said, congrats, Dad, on it, and asked me to check my calendar, which you'd added an ultrasound appointment to. And the cake, I could tell, was from QFC, and it was really good.
News like that is hard to keep to yourself. It wasn't long before we decided to tell our closest friends and family. We started at my parents' house over dinner. Telling my mom was the most fun.
And then you go over and grabbed something and you started walking it over to me. And I think I caught a glimpse of Dr. Seuss and I was like, oh my God. I went, you're not drinking wine and you're giving me a Dr. Seuss book. What's going on? And I hadn't opened the book and I go, are you having a baby? And you just looked at me and said, yes, look at the book. And I opened it up. I didn't read it clearly. I just opened it up because I knew, and I saw baby. I think I screamed. I might have screamed. And I instantly cried, instantly grabbed you, pulled you into a hug, and was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. It was so awesome. I was so excited for everybody, for you guys, for the future, for everything. I was over the moon. I was just over the moon.
So, some stuff about me. I'm a planner. The last thing I do before bed is check my calendar for the next day. Most days, my purse doubles as an emergency kit. I never leave the house without a stash of anything I might need between the moment I leave and the moment I return. Still, I recognize the planning part of family planning only goes so far. A lot of it is up to science and timing. And as one of my friends puts it, a million little things going exactly right to create the life you eventually welcome into the world. But when Christian and I talked about starting our family, we never imagined just how out of our control everything would get. It started with symptoms that had me on the phone with nurses almost daily, followed by a scary incident at work one day in February.
I mean, I was concerned, obviously. You'd had some concerning symptoms, but that they also were things that could happen in a normal pregnancy, and was just, you know, kind of trying to be optimistic. But like driving to your office that day was the first time where I really thought, like, it sounds like this probably isn't going to end well for us.
That trip to the hospital was way more traumatic than I was expecting. I remember it was a lot of hurry up and wait, very clinical, not very empathetic, which is what you expect when you go to the ER. And I remember I had a really invasive ultrasound. We hadn't even had an ultrasound yet, so that was my first ultrasound.
I think everybody, including the nurses and eventually the doctor, knew what was going on. You have to still go through all these really traumatic steps just to kind of learn the inevitable at that point.
And I said to you after the ultrasound, I said, I don't feel pregnant anymore. Grieving someone you never met is complicated. When I signed up for pregnancy apps to track my progress, I never thought I'd have to choose between save this child or remove child from profile. You know those apps, the ones filled with tips for being the perfect pregnant person, the ones that compare the size of your developing baby to different types of fruit. When I woke up the day after that traumatic ER visit, I stared down at a little blueberry, marking the first day of my 7th week of pregnancy, a pregnancy that didn't exist anymore. I always thought it was ridiculous comparing the stages of fetal development to a fruit basket, but it was especially jarring that morning. But not as jarring as that early morning phone call to my mom.
I was on my way to work, and there was just something about the tone in your voice. I knew something was wrong. And then you told me, and I think, honestly, for me, my first concern was you. I mean, I was, of course, disappointed, but I was more worried about how this was going to affect you than anything else and how you were doing, you and Christian.
When it comes to pregnancy and parenthood, society tells you there's a right and a wrong way to feel, a right and wrong way to share the news, a right and wrong way to prepare, to labor, to feed. The list goes on and on and on. But there's no blueprint for dealing with a miscarriage. There's no BuzzFeed list for the top 20 ideas for announcing your failed pregnancy. And society doesn't offer much beyond deafening silence. If it happens to you and you're brave enough to share, you learn about a catalog of traumatic moments your loved ones also suffered in that deafening silence. I didn't expect that we'd conceive so soon, and the surprise of that abruptly changed us. It was day one of something new, something scary and better than we could ever imagine. But after the miscarriage, we couldn't begin imagining our new life, and our old one felt incomplete. And as little as we planned for our failed pregnancy, we were even less prepared for what came next. Washington started shutting down March 12th, 2 weeks after the country's first coronavirus death was reported here. Schools started closing, followed by restaurants and bars. Soon, everything was shuttered. As hospitals braced for Armageddon, we had to decide, do we try again?
So when things did start shutting down, and we had already had the conversation that we were going to start trying as soon as we could, and we were hearing that we didn't know what hospitals were going to look like in March, April, May, were you second-guessing our decision to start a family amid all that craziness?
I was a little bit. I thought, is this the responsible thing to do? You know, should we intentionally put ourselves in a position where we're going to require a, you know, good amount of medical care over the next 9 months? You kind of have the same probably economic concerns that a lot of people do. What's the world going to look like 9 months from now when, you know, we'll have to support this third person in our family? And but, you know, I think once you make the decision that you want to start a family and be parents, it's not something that you just put on hold.
As we contemplated, should we or shouldn't we, Christian and I didn't realize the decision was already out of our hands. We eventually learned that just as Washington was shutting down around us, another 9-month countdown had already started.
Wow.
That's the only way to describe the first time you hear the sound of your baby's heartbeat at that first ultrasound. We didn't get the chance to hear that sound the first time. A heartbeat means the risks are significantly lower. But more than that, a heartbeat makes it real. We're doing this. We're on the clock. That's when the new worries took over our old ones. Thinking about the future when the future is entirely uncertain. Having your first baby is about as uncertain as it gets. When you throw in a pandemic that some of the smartest people in the world still don't fully understand, it's nearly impossible to imagine the future. I knew that any pregnancy that came after my first one wouldn't be the same, but I had no idea just how different this next one would be.
The first time, every day between when we found out you were pregnant and when we found out that we'd had a miscarriage, it was all I thought about. You know, just thinking about September and that time of year and having a newborn and how, you know, how excited my parents and your parents would be and how my routine would change. And, you know, I'd be at the Keurig in the morning making coffee and just thinking like, man, 8 months from now, I'm going to be doing this and we'll have, you know, our son or daughter will be rolling around in the living room or whatever. And now, obviously, I think about it every day and a healthy amount every day, but I feel like anytime you're going through anything challenging, the best thing that anybody can do for themselves is to, you know, it's the most cliche thing in the world, but worry about what's in front of you right now. The next task, the next day, cooking your next meal, living where your feet are and worrying only about what's in front of you and what you can get done right now.
When you're in quarantine and nothing around you is certain and you have no idea what the next week, let alone weeks or months, has in store, it can be really upsetting to think that far in the future. And I need to be in control. And you already have such a lack of control when you're expanding your family, and I don't know, this just feels like piling on.
Thought to myself, do I need to quarantine myself and your dad for the whole month of December so that if this is crazy, we might have an opportunity to hold our grandbaby? And if the risk is still out there, even if we quarantined ourselves, would we still want to take a chance and be around the baby? It's really uncertain.
We try not to think about whether grandma and grandpa will get to hold our baby in the hospital. Or if anyone will get to see our son or daughter, even from a distance, in those first weeks or months. Still, despite this absolute mess of a year, 2020 probably isn't going to be so bad.
there's like the classic scene that you see in movies, or in our case, The Office, because we've watched it 533 times all the way through. Everybody's there in the waiting room, you know, family, grandparents, whoever, they're in the waiting room, and dad comes out and scrubs in a surgical mask and says, it's a boy or it's a girl. And I think about that, whether it looks that way or another way, you know, maybe that's a FaceTime call or whatever, but if everything goes according to plan, we will have a newborn in December, and that'll be something to celebrate one way or the other.
What a redeeming thing to have happen at the very end of what has been a really crappy year otherwise. I think my favorite thing about the fact that our baby is going to be born in December 2020 is that hopefully when we look back at 2020, that's what we remember about this year. Not that we didn't get to see our friends or go to our favorite places or get our last vacation as a married couple without a baby, which we had to cancel. I think we're going to remember 2020 fondly, despite everything.
That story from KNKX's Kari Ploeg. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Will James, Kari Ploeg, and Paul Currington of Fresh Ground Stories. Florangela Davila is our executive producer. Be sure to subscribe to both our Sound Effect and Transmission podcasts. They're available everywhere you get your audio, and please be sure to rate and review them both. It really helps. You can also send us your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org and follow us on Facebook. Stay safe out there, and be sure to tune in next week. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.